We're just 2 seconds away from the second hour of this show. It is now exactly 5 o'clock. And thank you again for listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And here in this second hour from a September 10th book launch event held again at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Armand Garnett Ruffo with his latest book, The Dialogues, The Song of Francis Pagamagabo, and what the book is bringing his libretto of that story about, about the true story of this indigenous soldier in World War I to the page. And he explains very well in the event that night, so I'll just leave it at that. First, as always, though, just my usual start of the hour announcement is that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And this, just like the first hours did, pretty much takes up the full hour. So let's go ahead and just move straight into, again, Armand Garnett Ruffo's September 10th book launch event. And here we go.
Thank you for coming out. It's so many people. When I was asked to do the intro, I was like, okay, we'll have a couple of people, we'll just hang out. But thank you for coming and to celebrate Armand's new book. My name is Julianne Okot-Bitek, and I'm an assistant professor in English and Gender Studies and Black Studies at Queen's. And I happen to be a colleague of Armand, so yay. So I'm going to introduce him and his work via a bio, but also to say a little bit about how I come to know Armand's work. So let me first start with the formal stuff, okay? Because otherwise I'll leave out stuff and get in trouble. Armand Garnett Ruffo is an Anishinaabe writer and poet and a band member of the Shapro Fox Lake Cree First Nation. He was born in the remote town of Shapro in Northern Ontario on Treaty 9 territory and has a career that spans over 40 years. It ranges from working out on the land as a harvester, working for Indigenous political and cultural organizations, working for foreign affairs out of Ottawa and abroad, and of course, working in academia, which has brought him and his family here to Kingston. Among all of this is his continuing love for literature and the arts in general. And I'll say a little bit about the arts in general, because that's how I come to know Armand afterwards. Armand discovered the library at a young age, where he spent much of his time. Not because he loved reading, that came later, but because the big old brick building was warm in the winter and cool in the summer. Today, Armand is recognized as a major contributor to both Indigenous literature and Indigenous literary scholarship in Canada. Moving from Northern Ontario to Toronto and then Ottawa in the late 70s, he began writing for the theater at a time when Indigenous theatrical movement was breaking new ground in Canada. He went on to write films, including an award-winning feature film, and he's even written a libretto, which brings us to his books. There are 12 books in multiple genres that he's either edited or written himself. These include Noval Morisot, Man Changing into Thunderbird. This is my own copy. Don't anybody claim it. But it hasn't been signed, so there's no proof that it's mine. And Treaty, which I saw here, but I think it's sold out now. Treaty Number, which was published in 2019. That's the one. Both finalists for the Governor General Literary Awards. He's also the recipient of an honorary life membership award from the League of Canadian Poets And in 2020, he was awarded the Lavner Canada Writers Trust Poetry Prize for his body of work. His most recent book that we are launching here tonight is The Dialogues, the song of Francis Begamagabo, and according to Armand, this may be his most experimental book, and he'll tell us why. But I want to take a moment to say how I met Armand, and I'm the one who's meeting Armand. Armand did not meet me. I was at a Shirk, no, at a Congress conference in Calgary, and I checked the Google, and it said it was 2016, so I know when it was. And I was invited there by Peter Midgley, who a couple of years ago, who was a writer in residence here, and he invited me to get the opportunity to talk about my own book, 100 Days, which I published in 2016. Yeah, so it had just come out. At the same time, there was an art exhibit in town, and I think this was in Calgary, and they were featuring the Indigenous Group of Seven, which I didn't know about. And so I went to check it out, and there was, I walked into this exhibit, and there was the art of Noval Moriso, Daphne Ojig, Carl Ray, Eddie Cobin, Joey Sanchez, and Alex Janvier, who just passed away not that long time ago. And I was absolutely stunned because I had never known, all the years in Canada, it was 20-something years in Canada so far, I had never known how powerful and how powerfully Indigenous art told us about the place we live in and how to think about this place and the future and everything around us. And then, you know how you're at a conference and you're like, okay, what should I attend? And so I went to see Armand presenting on Noval Moriso. And it was Noval Moriso's work that had me standing still, right? I could hardly move. And then he talked about Noval Moriso's work, and I thought, wow, someone can do this? Like, find an artist and then dig deep in their work and talk about it so fluently and so beautifully? And then I discovered he was a poet. I was like, yeah, of course. Of course someone can do that. And now he writes librettos, and now he's my colleague. So I'm good, and I'm really proud to present Armand Ruffo. Enjoy the evening.
Wow. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Chimabwech. So, I don't know what else to add. Kishikoike Dishna Kos, Shaplom and Dunjaba, Fox Lake. Yeah, I'm kind of stunned. So usually I like to read to myself in the washroom or something. So anyway, this book, it took me on quite a journey. I think most of the books do in some ways, but this one, it started off as a libretto, and I was commissioned to do it. And I was called a couple years ago, the Festival of Sound in Parry Sound, which is a classical venue. And so they wanted to honor Francis Begamagabo, who was the well-known, renowned World War I sniper. And he has garnered the most medals in the First World War for Canada. And so I was really hesitant. I signed on for various reasons, and partly because the Begamagabo family was involved in it as well. And then they asked me eventually, and it toured, and it's done quite well. It's going off to Vancouver next summer if you get a chance. It has an orchestra, a chamber orchestra, and played here a couple of years ago at the Bader. Anyway, so they asked me if I would be interested, a number of people, not so much the organizers, but the audience, if I would, do you have a book? And I wrestled with the idea, how would I turn this libretto into a book, because it wasn't made for the page. It was made for the stage. And believe it or not, the way the kind of mind works, I woke up in the middle of the night. I said, I don't know if Heather remembers that. I stood right up and said, I know how to do it. So I wasn't even thinking. I think if you're creative, if you're a writer, artist, whatever, that's what happens. Your subconscious starts working. Anyway, so this is called the dialogues, and I had to rework the libretto. It's divided into four sections. The first section is called Faith Act. The second section is called War Act. The third section is called Homefront Act. And the last section is called Balancing Act. And so it jumps through time and space. And so I'll start with it, and I won't, I don't know if I'll read Balancing Act. Balancing Act, the last act, I was trying to intervene into the narrative as much as possible, provide the narrative, so the dialogue is talking to the narrative. And the last act is translated into Anishinaabe Moyen, because part of my intervention then was to foreground Anishinaabe culture as much as possible. And also I wanted to contribute to the survival of our language. And one of the big problems with our language, we don't have much. It's an oral language, obviously, but we don't have a lot of text. So this provides another text, so people can read the English and then read the Anishinaabe Moyen. Okay, so Faith Act. And it starts, "The War That Will End War," H.G. Wells, 1914. Scene 1. Herein, the narrator makes his appearance and in a steady voice introduces Francis Pegamagabo. Picture him, male, 25, Anishinaabe, Ojibwe, compact, sturdy, brave, self-reliant, defiant. He steps out of the shadows and stands quietly in a distant corner of the trench. In his left hand, he holds up a pinch of tobacco that he raises up to Gichimanido, the great mystery. He prays aloud so that the Creator might hear him and take pity on him and his company. He begins by honoring the four directions. Together, we will fill the spaces between. Example 1, short note on pronunciation. Unless you know something about Anishinaabe Moyen, you are probably wondering how to pronounce the words. Sound it out. Let the vowels roll off your tongue. Pe-ga-ma-ga-bo. Does that help? Wabenukwe, master, keeper of the East. Shwanagishik, keeper, ruler of the South. Nanabusho, keeper, guardian of the West. Kwaiten, keeper, spirit of the North. Translations can never be exact. Inner novel, Fugitive Pieces, a book mired in war, Anne Michaels writes that reading a poem in translation is like kissing a woman through a veil. You never quite get it. She refers to the difficulty of translating Greek poetry. What about Anishinaabe Moyen? Linguists consider it one of the most complex languages on the planet. 6,000 verb forms, a reflection of a people's reality. Scene 2. Herein Francis Pegamagabo is singled out and ordered to perform a miracle. The war has been raging on the Western Front for less than a year, and thanks to new technology, machine guns, tanks, airplanes, long-range artillery, tens of thousands of soldiers have already died in the slaughter. Millions more will follow. Any thought of a quick end is mired in mud and blood. To break the stalemate, the enemy turns to a new killing tool, chlorine gas, and the Canadians are without masks. A stiff upper lip is required to carry on. World War I becomes the first industrialized war. Up to this point, the world has never experienced anything like it. Until then, soldiers ride horses, parade them, march in formation. Horse nations spring up on the Great Plains and become synonymous with the Comanche, Kiowa, Apache, Blackfoot, Cree, who become renowned for their horsemanship. Warriors track on horses, attack on horses, live on horses. In this future nightmare, soldiers find themselves riding and marching into a spray of 30 caliber machine gun bullets that tear them to pieces in minutes, in seconds, I should say. Airplanes raise the ground, aerial bombing, our tanks and artillery the likes of never seen before. As for horses, they become relegated to transport and lie dead in the fields. Eyes blank, flies buzzing overhead. Scene 3, as you can see, I'm skipping around. Herein the reel rolls backwards. Birth and death, if anything, is dramatic. Born in 1889, Francis Pegamagabo, an Ojibwe boy, is now age 2. And unlike any other boy, unaware of what he will go on to do. But dark clouds appear on his horizon, upheaval the height of mountainous waves, grave enough to change the course of a child's life. His father dies, his mother gravely ill. An adopted grandfather raises the boy and teaches him ceremony, custom, and tradition. Shaped by glory days of old quest and vision, the sickly child takes it upon himself to entreat the help of the sun Manido. He rises at dawn and runs from village to shoreline, training to be warrior strong. There is the dream, always the same dream, of a life tested, a life lived, and that's when fully. Remember, you are hearing music, instrumentation, B-flat clarinet, double on A, bassoon, B-flat trumpet, doubles on piccolo, trumpet D, or B-flat, trombone, violin, counterbass, percussion, D-pan, vibes, suspended cymbals, large and small, bass drum, floor tom, side drum, snare drum, mark tree, wood block. Scene 4, a spiritual encounter. Herein Francis has an unexpected encounter with his dear spirit. Francis, in my dream, I see a beautiful deer, head raised, nose up, ears twitching. I approach from downwind, but it turns on me, and I realize this is meant to be. It is a spirit, a manidu, in the body of a deer. I know who you are. And so you do. I am your relative, Pegamagabo, Francis Pegamagabo, Caribou clan. Gentle and swift, and yet strong, and made to defend these qualities in the body of a man. No, you have kin, human and other than human, to help you on your life path. Do it now. Be done with the task. Francis raises his rifle, but he cannot begin it. He cannot bring himself to shoot. Why the deer spirit? What became clear to me as my roots grew and I came into consciousness upon thinking and listening to elders and artists and thinkers over the years was that the newcomers to Turtle Island encountered a belief system so far outside of Western philosophical tradition that it was unrecognizable to them. In their ignorance, they quickly dismissed it as primitive and without purpose or worth. And in doing so, they dismissed an ancient body of knowledge about the natural world that indigenous peoples worldwide have drawn upon to find connection to all living things. A fundamental ethos defining our space and place in the world. We are currently living, or better I say, non-living, with the consequences of this rejection. young man with a coronet. Turn of the 20th century. Francis is a modern man living in two worlds. Think for a minute what is going on in the earliest 20th century modernism. The first mapping of the gene, the chromosome, Einstein's theory of general relativity, Picasso's blue period dulled to Guernica's monochrome vision of war, Kandinsky's Blue Rider movement, Jelly Roll Morton's Jelly Roll Blues, Armstrong picking up the horn and turning it into Fitzgerald's jazz age, Josephine tearing up the dance floor. It's all happening. Francis, when they press me about spiritual matters, I shrug as though in half belief. I don't argue or fight. I seek balance in a world both ancient and modern. I press for support to go to school and learn to play the cornet in a local brass band. I'm 21 years old and free, living in a new century, and I sign on as a seaman and travel the Great Lakes. War Act. Herein Francis rationalizes why he and so many other Anishinaabe feel compelled to enlist. Then he's back on his island home in a time to witness the beginning of the darkest unknown, the greatest crime when reason is abandoned to mankind's folly and the great circle of life reflecting the promise of youth is shattered. August 1914, Great Britain and Germany are at war, and within days, Francis and thousands of other young men enlist. Officer, let me get this straight. You insist on fighting in a war that's not yours? The officer looks him over begrudgingly and would rather send the Indian on his way. But all the same, Francis digs his heels in and explains why he and so many of his people feel compelled to do their part. Hidden History, 1812. In 1812, a war party from the Nipigon Reserve paddled the entire length of Lake Superior and proceeded to Queenston Heights, where it joined the forces of General Brock. Anybody try that? Paddle the long distance of Lake Superior? A short history of war. Maybe begin with the Romans, who turned killing into a tactical art. 8 centuries before Christ, 6 centuries after, and they were still at it. Or maybe start earlier with the Peloponnesian War, Athens and Sparta, a stone's throw apart, and their hands around each other's throat. Poor Sparta, poor Athens, nobody wins forever. Then there's the colossal statue, that colossal statue of Genghis Khan, perched on horseback, marching across the Mongolian plain. Legend has it he personally murdered millions, his army beheading a whole city at one sitting. Always somebody clubbing somebody. Brings me to that first big scene in Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. An ape takes his first swing with a jawbone, and there we have it. Our own voracious perpetual motion machine, the mechanism of death and suffering. No stopping it. A most pernicious thing. About 1400, possibly Genoa, a firearm which permitted one man to aim, load, and fire was developed. In its many stages of evolution, this firearm is referred to as the matchlock, and the matchlock evolved slowly. Serpentine, cock set, flint ignition, freezing spark, cap percussion, nibble detonation, pan urgency, butt plate recoil, patch box ordnance, nucleus breach, envision ramrod dystopia, a la barrel blaze, muzzle disruption, dimension stock and lock authoritative, plate prediction, key conquest, rear sight innovative, through future front sight intervention, commerce, wedge, precision, release, ball, hunger, hammer, trigger. From 1450 to 1600, the most glaring fault of the matchlock was that a lighted match had to be carried at all times. It was not uncommon for the arbuster to be caught without matches lit, rendering their weapons useless. By 1600, settlement in the New World by the Spanish, French, English, Dutch, and Swedes had begun. Hostilities involving indigenous populations began almost immediately. Armor remained in fashion for some time. So that was a quote, I should say, from Brian G. Given, with a little intervention there. A word from the narrator's narrator. I know what you are thinking. The narrator knows everything. Hand of God, sleight of hand, same thing, depending on our father who are dealing the hand. The 1st Battalion arrives in Europe and marches steadfast into Belgium, arrives at a spot called Ypres, still not claimed by the Germans. But to the horror, the Canadians find themselves totally unprepared for the war. None have experienced anything like this before. A foot of sewer water in the trenches, surrounded by sharp barbed wire fences. A steady barrage of artillery fire dropping upon the men. The shells disinter the bodies, then bury them again. Sniper bullets zinging while ghostly flares illumine the dead. 6,000 cylinders of gas released in the air. Soldiers vomiting, turning green, running scared. A stalemate of armies dug in like dung beetles, fatly fed on a daily ration of blood meal. A hit, home, run, drone on. Rule number one, evade. Answer a question with a question. Rule two, not too much. Don't run, or it becomes treason. Rule three, all oiled up, we march with righteousness on the side of the gun. Rule four, memorize the proper language. Without it, everything falls apart. Military operation, military mining, skirmish, shoot, scoot, scorched earth, circumvailing, information, management, route pincer, maneuver, guerrilla tactics, extraction point, friendly fire, low-level bombing, artillery barrage, breach. Check your language. Language grown from language into more language. Clandestine, convert, serendipitous, deceitful, cunning. Add to this language a few words like casualty, grief, maimed, mad, sad, lad, still wet behind the ears, good for cannon fodder. Build on your language. Come up with your own, though don't intentionally muddy the water, trying too hard to show down, neutralizing live resource, cherry-bombed hospital, blood infusion, cocktail, limited engagement ring, whatever the fuck that means, drone on. Okay. Oh, I'm getting to the end here. Officer, I see a few men behaving like you and putting down tobacco. This is a Christian war, by George. What are these things you do? Francis, look around. The constant bombing has turned the land into a graveyard, skeleton trees marking the dead. I take a piece of one of the branches and put it in my mouth and become the gray earth. My medicine is strong and I feel invisible, invincible. how many times is war mentioned in the Bible? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13? Clearly God is a busy man. Tonight we will sit in our assigned seats, and when the curtain goes up on the side of war, we will war on. Let us begin with Genesis and run to Exodus, if that is your persuasion, and go for that from there. The Lord is a warrior. Authorized King James Version, Exodus 15:3. Or put it another way, to even the playing field, the Lord is a man of war. Revised Standard Catholic Edition, Exodus 15:3. A righteous act bleeding the good book. Not your persuasion? Look, we drag our weapons behind us like a tail. A newsflash. 8, October 2023. Today the manuscript and the Middle East explodes again. Hamas attacks Israel and turns a music concert into a field of slaughter. Mm. Israel retaliates, sends in fighter aircraft and pounds Gaza into the ground. Hundreds, thousands dead and counting. Tit for tat. Mm. Rat-a-tat-tat, go the bombs, go the guns. Boom, 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 go the bombs. So it goes. Humankind does what we do. Homefront Act. A returned hero, here in Francis, returns home and struggles without support. What about those who no one sees? No shattered bones or missing limbs? A wound whose roots go deeper than the tallest majestic tree. Let us mourn for the ones who died, were resurrected and returned, abandoned and forgotten in a country they no longer recognized. A short euphemism alert. To snipe, verb. From to shoot snipes, a kind of bird. Also to shoot at a target, or to shoot at an individual, or to put yourself in danger, as in the risk of getting shot yourself and maimed as in amputated, or killed as in death, dead, died, in action, yet another euphemism. Okay, I'm gonna jump here now and finish off. I'm gonna finish with two pieces. A note from the street. Earlier today, I had a few errands to do downtown and flew over the fallen, the homeless, shell-shocked, battle-scarred, life-imploded, street-crippled, brother, sister, daughter, son, pressed hard into their concrete bed. From my vantage point, I could see they were begging our survival. As our flock veered away in another direction, I swooped in and dropped a few dollars, which they eagerly grabbed and ate. Considering a sacred song, that's the way, isn't it? We are told, and we should never forget, to realize we are never alone. Our ancestors, the ones who foresaw us as we see them, are always with us. And this love is like a great wind that holds us up when we least expect it and carries us like children across the sky. Well, as you can see, it really jumps around, and I tried to keep it together, but if there are any questions? Start the book. Try to. Yeah.
When I heard and I saw that you originally libretto, the first question in my head was, a libretto? What is a libretto? So me and Patrick looked it up and were like, a libretto? So
it is a libretto?
I know you said that you were commissioned to write it, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how it was to move from the genre of writing poetry, writing art criticism, writing all other things into writing the libretto, and what that was like.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that. And so the libretto, of course, it's a narrative. It's put to music, usually classical music. And the thing, when I first wrote the libretto, it was about three times as big as it is. And I was so enthusiastic, and I wrote it, and I brought it to the composer, and he looked at it, Tim, and he said to me, "Are they going to be talking all the time?" So I realized, yeah, of course, the music has to soar. So I guess the thing I learned about it is writing, you're writing a libretto story, and it's in verse because you want to make it have the same kind of rhythm as the music. It has to be in time with the music. So time and rhythm became very important. And then you want to pare it down because you have to develop a relationship with the composer, because you have to try to see what he see or hear. That's a better way to put it. Hear what he hears, because he wanted certain moments of quietness. He wanted, you know, when I'm reading about the war, in one point there's a crescendo. So you're kind of sitting there listening, and then the narrative comes in and talks about the war. But meanwhile, and it was fabulous because the woman, I forget, what's her name? Terrible, I forget her name. She was amazing, and she had pan drums and gongs, and so she was kind of just laying into the percussion while the war thing, and then suddenly it stops, the silence. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I even have a piece in here, and at the end of the book it says, a moment of silence, and then I couldn't read this one because it's the score of the music. Mm-hmm. A moment of silence, and then the score, and mm-hmm. the score starts slowly and build. So you're really trying to help, if I can, assist the composer with his vision of with the music. So you can't be on a different track. You have to be on the same track together. But the biggest thing I learned is that you have to make it concise so there's room for the music. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for the question. Anyway, if you're in Vancouver, it'll be playing there again next summer. Yeah.
So the things that you learned in doing the libretto and then doing this, do you think you'll carry on, like the concision that you were saying? Like, will this influence your next work?
Oh, I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
if I have my choice, I'd do something completely different, which I think I'm doing. One of the challenges when they asked me just write the libretto for the page, it just seemed kind of very one-dimensional. And that's why I included all those kind of interventions. So all the narrative is on the left side, and all the interventions are on the right side. And kind of they talk, in a sense, to the narrative. And maybe you didn't get that sense, but when you read it, you'll say, oh, yeah, you know. Yeah, and it ranges widely what I'm talking about. Yeah. And I think the constant in the... So it's the like this faith act, because he's starting, you know, and it's very kind of... starting with his faith, he's growing up, he's getting these teachings from his grandfather, then war act, he's plunged into the war, home front act, he's traumatized, he comes back, and then, of course, balancing act, where he translates the whole thing. But so you're kind of following him throughout it. Yeah.
The whole thing feels kind of operatic, and I'm wondering how you put yourself in the feet of someone such as this, and also in the foot of opera.
Well, I mean, there's another piece in there about Tim and I collaborating. We were constantly on the phone to each other. We became buddies, you know, good friends, because you're constantly... He would send me electronically a piece of music and say, listen to this, what do you think? And I'd say, oh, that's great. And he'd say, now this is going to be in this part of the story. He didn't know the story so much, but he said, you know, in Francis's life, this would fit when he's coming out of the war and back up in back in Canada, and he's traumatized. So I'd have to say, okay, now I'm going to visualize this. But I think we can all do that, you know, in a sense, because I think we're very visual people because we watch, you know, it's all around us. We watch TV, movies. But so I was just kind of imagining it on the stage playing out, you know? And then I would think of the narrative. And the narrative, once the narrative came, it came fast. I was in Halibut. But it just came really quickly, the narrative, at least the first draft.
Were you envisioning it as an opera?
It was. I was commissioned.
Oh, very beautiful. Okay.
Yeah, he told me all the instruments, and he sent me some kind of real preliminary things he had, and other things he had composed. So I knew to. And then he was composing while I was writing it. Or I'd send him something. I'd said, oh, this part about Francis, you know, I didn't read the part, but he gets back and he wants to buy a cow, and the Indian agent won't even let him buy a cow. So I said, oh, let's put this in, and because he's, you know, now he's dealing with regular life and he's having a hard time. And he would then say, okay. He'd compose some music, send it back to me, and I'd change things or suggest things. And so it was really, I think that for that kind of collaboration, you really have to be on the same page with the composer. And he, and vice versa.
Having read your book on Morisot, and then also this one, I'm thinking about how deeply you go inside the character. And so I'm wondering, what is your visitation practice with those people that you're writing about, and how long they stay with you?
Yeah, well, you know, both of them, I obviously couldn't visit Francis because he's long passed away, but I got to meet his family and I spent time there. And Brian, the person who did the translation, so I don't take credit for the translation. What I did probably messed it up. I told him that. But I would call him middle of the night and he was very receptive. I would say, what about this piece? What's this mean? Give me three options. Mm-hmm. Thinking he'd send me back three options and I think this one would work. So we were kind of very close. And so with Morris, so Norval, you know, I got to know him a little bit, but I don't know. I just get into the characters, you know. I'm just thinking about them all the time. So, I think that's the only. You just think about it. It's, you know, pieces of poetry you work on, really, like you plunge in and then it's gone, because it's short, and I love that form because it is. Unless you're writing, well, I guess in a sense, this libretto is a long poem, and you know, long poem in there, but something like this, you're kind of always, you know, revisiting it. You're always kind of living with it. Mm-hmm. Caroline?
Yeah. Along the same vein, I was wondering about, like, the research part of it. Like, I don't think it's all fantasy. Like, you did a lot of work to flesh it out as accurately as it unfolded.
I'm working on another historical piece, and I think you can do too much research. So, this I didn't do that much, like, official research. I kind of talked to the family a lot, and then I read a two books. One by Brian about his family and his great grandfather, and one about war. Reference to Francis, but that's it. I didn't do that much. I mostly spoke to the family. And I think that was a good thing because you can really do too much, I think, and make it sound like a history book or something, you know. So I didn't want to do that. But yeah, I think you gotta let it go at some point. I don't know, I keep telling myself that. Let it go.
I'm curious then to follow up on that, like, because it does seem to be very intertextual at times, and you're bringing in quotes and allusions, and I'm wondering then if that's not part of, you're feeling it as like an official research practice, like how do you bring those in, and how does that relationship of those external texts come into the work?
Yeah, it's kind of like I said, that's why I called it, I couldn't come up with a title. I had all these titles, and finally I realized, it's kind of a dialogue between the libretto, which, you know, semi kind of, because I changed a little bit, but, and and I was trying to fill in the gaps where the fill in where the music might have been, you know, because there's no music, obviously. So I thought, well, that's when I woke up. I said, I can kind of create these interventions into the text, and kind of extrapolate a little bit. And you know, war isn't just back there. War was prior to, you know, World War I, and it's still going on as we speak. So I wanted to kind of just talk about that. I think that's where the book differs from the libretto. You don't get that in the libretto. It's just Francis's story, whereas the interventions allow us to realize, man, this has been going on, and why are we so wrapped up in killing ourselves? You know? And there's a piece I didn't read, and I'm just going to read the title. And it's called Last Wrong World Winning. You know, it's because we constantly, look what's going on now. And so, I set out purposely not to say, you know, this person did this, this person did that, and this person deserved this. No, it's not about that at all. It's just about humankind in general, and right from the get-go to now, and why we can't stop it. We just seem to be on this perpetual motion machine, and we can't get off. And, you know, is it why? I mean, is it Kubrick saying, you know, that first jawbone did it, you know? I was thinking a lot about intertextuality while I was writing it, and I came up with the idea that, and I don't know, maybe, I don't know if it's, I have direct quotes, but I realized, man, these quotes, they read like poetry, you know. So I'm using quotations as poems.
Yeah, what were you listening to when you realized that you had to write a libretto? What did you listen to prepare for it, and as it was ongoing?
So, when I was writing the libretto, I was only listening to Kim's music, you know. When I'm writing, I can't listen to any music with lyrics, so I listen to jazz. Mm. Hmm. I cannot have anybody words. Mm. So, and fortunately, I really like jazz, so it's easy. I did the shift to classical music, and I'm not a classical aficionado. I know probably that much about classical music. But I did know, they gave me a model. They said it's going to be like Stravinsky's A Soldier's Story. That was kind of... So originally, the Festival of Sound said, well, we're going to mount Stravinsky's A Soldier's Tale, I guess it's called. Soldier's Story, Soldier's Tale. And we're going to do the Song of Francis Pigamagabo at the same time, Sounding Thunder was called. But because of such a positive reception for Sounding Thunder, they scrapped doing Stravinsky. And so they just did that. But I had been listening to Stravinsky a little bit, and then Tim started sending me his music.
So in working with Francis's family specifically, I noted that the person who did the translation was his grandparents.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it like learning about the spirituality?
Francis, it was amazing because, you know, he was a very spiritual person, and there's a piece at the back about called, you know, what's important to Francis. Yeah, I think it's, I forget what it's called here. Yeah, on what really matters, if you turn to that one on 89. So it was a real, you know, I'm always have trepidation, you know, when I did Morisot, I kind of tiptoed to Norvell, and he just kind of said, what took you so long? and when I met the Pigamagabo family, they just embraced me as well. So that, you know, I think they really wanted me to do it. So it was really, it was really nice.
Yeah, a couple of us today are students, and I know a couple of us are here enrolled in a creative writing memoir class, and we're currently navigating how to stay truthful in creative writing. And I always was curious on this project, what you felt your responsibilities were for telling these stories, and also your responsibilities as an artist, and how that process was for you.
Yeah, I don't, you know what? That's a big question. I don't, you know, I try to tell everything I do truthfully, to the best of my, you know, I don't, like I'm an old dude, man. I don't have to hide anything anymore. So, no, to be
it's
honest,
a weird concept, so.
To be honest, you know, I just try to tell it truthfully, whatever I learned. You know, the Norvell book, I remember the biography. I just didn't feel I had said everything I wanted to say, and these poems kept coming, and I ended up writing this, which is even has other pieces in there that are kind of even hard hitting. So I, you know, I kind of just want to tell the truth. I think this truth, it's, you know, we need truth. We need truth. You know, it's one of our sacred teachings. Truth is central. So you have to tell your truth. You know, and my, you know, it's not to say I have the truth. I have my own truth that I have to try to convey. But I think my advice to young writers is, try not to censor yourself. You know, don't think your mother's over your shoulder reading you, Jeff. You know, just, you know, write. Write your truth.
Thank you very much.
Oh, sorry.
I was just wondering how you found, I found the poems like very deeply sensorial. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you felt adapting that kind of sense world when you took out the sound element. To just kind of have it be on the page, like was kind of spatiality very important
yeah.
and layout and things.
Yeah, for sure. I think the publisher hated me for a few things. I was very concerned when I said I was writing it for the page. I looked at it. I wrote the book like that, so I was looking at two pages. I was looking at right and left and how they work with each other and that kind of thing. So I was very concerned. Yeah, and yeah, for sure. And you know, because the libretto was standing alone, I really wanted to play with sound, and I hope I conveyed some of that in the pieces. Okay, one more.
I guess connected to that question, what's the story of the bold wallpaper where you've got your text superimposed on a page that just reads bold?
Yeah.
And how difficult was that for you?
Yeah, they that went back and forth. It's too dark, too light. I don't know if it works or not. But it's interesting because it says bomb or born. You know, it's playing with that text behind. And I just wanted to foreground that this is like a constant backdrop. You know, that it's there all the time. And you know, we could be sitting here and somebody else is getting killed in some part of this planet. It's always happening, you know? And so you have to, you can't dwell on it constantly or else you'll go mad. But I think as human beings, it's our responsibility to not never forget, you know, and be aware and try to do something if we can in our own little way. And that's why I couldn't, when I started working on this, I could not let it appear that it's in the past, and that's why it's always in this thing.
And you just heard from a September 10th book launch event held at Novel Idea Bookstore, Armand Garnett Ruffo, with his latest book, The Dialogues, the Song of Francis Pegamagabo, and with it bringing his libretto about the true story of this indigenous soldier in World War I to the page. It is 54 minutes after 5 o'clock, and first of all, my heartfelt thanks to all of you out there for listening today, and equal thanks to Armand and all involved in that wonderful event that evening. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Get that done after I get home after the show every Friday evening. Those will, each week's show remains there for 3 years. And and if you go there, it's pretty easy, if, especially if you know the date that it appeared, it is easy to find what plays in that particular hour. So anyway, I just have a few messages here to take us out, but what I would suggest you do is stay tuned for 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music. It's hosted by Rob Carnell, and it'll come up right after these. Have a great week, everybody.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Have you been dumped? Left all alone? Just want to find your soulmate? Look no further, because your new best friend is waiting for you at the Kingston Humane Society. The Kingston Humane Society is a nonprofit animal organization founded in 1884 that is supported solely by the community, receiving no government funding to assist in their mission of caring for injured, abused, and homeless animals, with the goal of creating families and homes for the animals. They are the only open shelter in the region, accepting every animal brought to them with compassion, respect, and humane assistance. If you want to donate to help these animals find their best friends, or if you're interested in finding the new love of your life, please visit KingstonHumaneSociety.ca. Everyone just needs a little love.
In the 1970s, four Kingston women got together to discuss the idea of creating a community house, a place where grassroots organizations, families, and groups could gather, a place where food could be prepared and shared, new skills could be learned, and lively discussion could be encouraged. For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As it becomes safe once again to gather in person, we look forward to providing the Kingston community with a comfortable and convenient place to reconnect with one another. Located in downtown Kingston, we operate 7 days a week. For more information on Kingston Community House and how to book, please visit kingstoncommunityhouse.org.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, it won't bother you. He's a busy man.